going to start winding up, we do have two classes that are basically a review this week and next week, and then just a couple of classes pick up some topical studies, and then Kevin will be starting to teach, and he will be teaching Ecclesiastes, and that will start in the first part of January. Okay, so when we started out, just doing, first of all, we did a broad overview, and then we went, we set the scene for through the Roman church and Paul and Rome and what was happening in Rome at the time. And then we went and did a overview, which was just kind of an encapsulation of the book of Romans. Then we went back and we did another overview, but the way we did it was we looked at the key words that were involved in the book of Romans. Then we came back and did a study. I would call it a chapter-by-chapter study, but it was more of the breaks where the chapters are, not necessarily where the breaks in the thought are. So we tried to do it by breaks in the thought. When we started out, one of the things that we talked about was the fact that the book of Romans was not a book originally. It was not part of the New Testament because the New Testament did not exist in its collected form. So when it was written, it was written as a letter to a group of Christians who were in a city. And he was in Corinth, Paul was in Corinth, and the Christians were in Rome. The Christians in Rome were in Rome, so who he wrote the letter to. And so he wrote this letter, and the distance between those two places is about the distance from here to Denver. So that kind of gives us a sense of space. It's not like they're world apart. They're, you know, it's travelable. You know, that's only half the distance by wagon train if you're coming from the East Coast. In fact, I'm not even sure if it's exactly half, but somewhere in that neighborhood. But he wrote it as a letter. So I passed out letters, and the letters, everyone's letter was written by Paul, without verses. No verses or chapters. The idea was that we would try and read it and approach it as the way they would read it and approach it, and try and not be guided by what the scholars later did when they divided it into chapters and verses. And number of times through the study we've said, you know, you can't stop at the end of this chapter, because if you do, you miss a big part of the point. Or you can't start at the beginning of this chapter without going back to the beginning of the last end of the last chapter, because if you do, you miss the point. So I would encourage you in your own personal studies to not just do that with Romans, but to think of that in terms of everything that we study. We need to read it the way it was written, and it wasn't written broken down into verses. There's one or two possible exceptions to that, and that would be Psalms and Proverbs. And I'm not sure, you know, those are pretty, the Psalms are songs, and they were broken into specific songs. So those, I guess we could say, were broken into chapters, but certainly not verses, unless you're thinking musically speaking, the Proverbs would be similar. So we then read the letter, okay? And if you have followed along and you have been here every class period, you will have read the book of Romans somewhere between 3 and 4 times over the last 9 months. We read it once, straight from the letter, okay, and it took us 2 Sundays. And then we have read it in chunks from the letter at least once. And then we've read it from our Bibles in verse form several times as we studied. So somewhere between 3 and 4 times we've read the book of Romans. So if you've been here, if you've done that, that's good. You should remember quite a bit. And it's good. Public reading of the word is good. So we talked about how the people would have viewed the letter, and they would have gotten it, and they would have gotten how many copies of it from Paul? one, okay? And it was probably carried by Phoebe, and Phoebe brought it, and she handed it to somebody, okay? We don't know who she handed it to. You know, I've got a couple guesses. If I were thinking of the group of people listed in chapter 16, who it would be likely that she did, but we have absolutely really no idea. So she handed the letter, so I said, okay, pretend she handed you the letter, and this is your letter, and it's your job to now keep the letter for the church, because somebody in the church had to be the keeper of that letter, right? Now, what would they have started to do almost immediately? Make copies. So lots of copies would then start to be made. But initially, there was just the one, and somebody had to be the keeper. And so to kind of emphasize the importance of that letter, we said, so hold on to your letter, because you're the keeper of the letter. So, do you have your letter? No, you don't have it. Some of you do. That's good. Okay. So, obviously, it's not that crucial for us, because we have, most of us have several Bibles. As indicated by the books that Daylene's been bringing that her father had, some of us have many, many. I picked up a couple versions myself, and I felt greedy, so I stopped. But there's been just a lot of different versions of the New Testament and Old Testament that Lauren had. So we don't have to hold on to a letter. We have it readily available, but that doesn't mean that it's any less significant. I think it helps me to think of it in those terms. This was something very precious when they got it. It wasn't, oh yeah, I got Romans. It was, they got a letter from Paul to them, and it was very important to them. And they would have cared for it very, very carefully. It would not have been something they forgot on the pew or somebody else's house, being as there probably were no pews. But they would have considered that quite a treasure. Okay, so we started out broadly in those terms. We talked a little bit about who the book was written to this church, and we've talked about it several times, so we won't go extensively into it. But if we look at the 16th chapter, we see some things both about who Paul was with when it was written, and Tertius, adds a little personal note at the end. He was apparently the scribe. So he adds a little note, and then the book lists out a bunch of the people that are in that congregation, and we see that it's a very personal letter. He is talking to them about some great, huge ideas and concepts, but he is talking to them very personally because he knows a lot of them. He talks about them individually. He has never been to Rome, but they were all kicked out of Rome, or most of the Christians were kicked out of Rome under Claudius in about 54, and probably came back in about 56, 57, somewhere in that area. And Paul wrote this letter to them in about 56. So he's writing this to them under Claudius. The guy who followed Claudius was Nero. Nero was probably responsible for Paul's death. Okay, so this is that period of time. From the time Christ is born until Paul writes this letter, it's only roughly 65 years. Okay, so we're not talking about this huge expanse of time. We're talking about Paul being born under who? Augustus, died under Jesus. Paul died under Nero. Jesus died under Tiberius. Okay, so it was Augustus, Tiberius, and then there was Caligula, who was a nut job, and then there was Claudius. Thank you. Totally blanked on it. Claudius. And then there was Nero. So you have this period of time of, just if we think of it in terms of world leaders, many of us have seen that many presidents in our lifetime. So it's this relatively short period of time that the church that Jesus died in, roughly 30 to 33 AD. Okay, and so it's only 30 years. You know, Paul's just writing this letter 30 to 35 years after Jesus died, and he's writing to this group of people who he has met on his, some of whom he has met on his trip, his missionary journeys. He's on his third missionary journey now when he writes this. He is going to go back to Rome shortly after he writes this. He's going to go back to Rome, and he's going to take with him some of the contributions that the Greek churches had made for the Judean Christians. And so he's going to go with whoever took it or take it himself. But he goes back to Rome and then, to Palestine. And then he is arrested, appeals, and ends up in Rome. Okay, he wants to go see them. He's close to them. He talks about, I've planned to come and see you, but my work has, you know, it's been prevented. I've been busy in Asia, and now, you know, I plan to come to you, and he plans to go to Spain also. We don't know if he ever got there. Okay, so this kind of is the background. We talked about why Paul was an ideal person to write to be an instrument. You know, somebody put me in my place because they said, well, he was the perfect tool because God picked him. So, that's right. That is the number one reason. He's the perfect tool because God picked him. What made him the perfect tool to write to Rome? Okay. Okay, so he was a Roman citizen. Okay, he was a Roman citizen by birth, which meant he had all of the rights under the empire. Okay, that made him ideal to speak to the Romans. He was also a Jew of Jews, you know, of the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, so he is addressing now a mixed congregation. So when he starts to talk about these differences, these cultural differences that exist between them, and how they're all the same under God's eyes, he's a perfect guy to do it. Okay? So we talked a little bit about that that idea that Paul really was prepared perfectly for being this tool, which and he had a, like Richard said, he had a real wake-up call in terms of conversions. I mean, he had been, he called himself the least of the apostles because he had persecuted the Christians. But yet, he was chosen. I find that great encouragement because, you know, none of us are perfect. So in spite of the fact that we are not perfect, God still has a way to use us if we are open to that. Okay, so we talked a little bit about Paul's challenge. Okay, Paul has a particular challenge in his preaching, and it has to do with the kind of material that he's always trying to teach, and he is trying to teach that the truth. Okay, but he's also trying to teach the relation of grace to the truth. And what do people do with that? Well, the Pharisees like to take the truth and expand on it, boil it down. And the Judaizing teachers wanted to apply Jewish principles to the church. And on the other hand, we have the people who really like the grace idea. And they would say that Paul was teaching what? Sin so that grace might abound. Okay? So he has this challenge. And Peter said, what did Peter say about Paul's teaching? Yeah, he said it's difficult. And as a result, what happened? Peter says this too. There are those who twist it to their own advantage. Okay? So when we look at Romans, we see that very clearly because he bookends he talks about the obedience of faith in the first chapter, he talks about the obedience of faith in the last chapter, but his fundamental purpose in the book is what? It's a dissertation on grace, okay? So he in the sixth chapter has to stop and say, okay, does that mean that we should sin so that grace may abound? And he says, by no means. He says, no. He does that twice. He says, no, that's not the deal. But then he goes back to explaining how grace applies to these two very diverse groups of Jews and Gentiles who now have become one in Christ, and how their relationships then form. Okay, any comments or thoughts? Okay. That's the first 6 weeks or so. Okay, then we talked a little bit about, or a lot about, the world that the church was born into and the influences that were there that pressed on the church. And what was that world like in 57 AD? What was Rome like? Aside from the pressures from persecutions, what was the world like for them? Just in a very, what is our world like? Travel's easy. Pardon? Yeah, it was booming. You know, economy. They had a huge road system. They could travel easily. Had the largest road system ever in the history of the world. It was the first massive road system. Created the ability to hold the empire together. Okay? So slavery was common. They had cruel sports games. They had a very structured governmental form. And then it was a hugely secular government, okay? And they had very little influence on it. They weren't told to go out, in the 13th chapter, you know, they weren't told to go out and conquer the political system. They were told to do what? In chapter 12. Present their bodies as a living sacrifice. They were supposed to go out and serve and change the world by serving. Okay, that's how they were to change the world. Okay, then we talked about we did a overview, and does everyone still have their outline, their brief outline? Okay. Or somebody want to? If you raise your hands, if you don't have one. Behind you, Dave. Okay, so this is the Cliff's Notes version, okay? And if we start out, we just say, okay, so what is it about? What is the book of Romans about? And we said, well, the theme is, for I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek, for it is the righteousness of God. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, but the righteous shall live by faith. Okay, so he said it is from faith to faith, the righteous will live by faith. And he is very unapologetic for this good news. This is the good news. The good news is God sent his Son, extended his grace to us, and we have the ability to accept that grace and to be justified in God's sight. So it's revealed from faith to faith. Now, what does that mean, from faith to faith? There's a couple of different ways that can be taken. One of them is it kind of starts with faith and ends with faith, which is correct. Okay. Now, in terms of the group he's thinking of, what is the other significant implication? Well, it's that it was by faith before and it's by faith now. It doesn't start by faith because Jesus died. It was by faith all the time. It was always by faith. You know, it was by faith. By faith, Abraham. Okay? Was Abraham before the law or after the law? He was before the law. So it was by faith. Abraham was justified by faith, and he makes a point of that, before the law became into place. Okay? And now he's talking to them under grace, under the new dispensation that has been established, and he tells them it is still by faith. It's by faith. Started out as faith by faith, and it ended up by faith. It's by faith. And that, so then if we look at a little fuller, the essence of the letter, it's the gospel of Christ. It's the power of salvation from faith to faith. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All, we are justified as a gift by his grace, which we have through Christ Jesus. We have that redemption through Christ Jesus. We obtained our introduction by faith into grace, and we exult in the hope. Okay, so he says, he also says there in the fifth chapter, he says, we stand in that hope. We stand in that grace. It's not something we step into and step out of and step into and step out of. We talked about the fact that when it talks about being righteous, being right with God does not mean that we are perfect. It means we are forgiven. And it doesn't mean we necessarily catch our mistake at the time. Now, that doesn't mean that we can go on sinning so that grace may abound. No, that's not the point. If we read over in 1 John, we read about if you practice righteousness, you are righteous. If you practice sin, you are not. And we talked about what it means to practice. Okay? It doesn't mean that you are perfect. It means it is your state of being. It is your manner of life. You strive to be righteous. And when you are not righteous and you catch yourself, you are going to correct that. Okay? But you are righteous. And you live in a relationship with Christ that is one that is you stand in his grace. Okay. Now that has that edge that we are comfortable with sometimes because, well, yeah, but you can't sin because grace will cover you. No, and Paul is exactly driving down that narrow road, and he doesn't go off into the ditch on either side. He tells it right, and if we get it right, we don't let other people steal grace from us because they misinterpret grace, like Peter is saying. He says, yeah, they twist it to their own destruction. No, that's not what grace is about. Grace is not about the ability to live an unrighteous life. It's the ability to live a pure life before God because we are justified, but we do need to live a righteous life, one that is where we practice righteousness. Okay. And then he says, once we've done that, then what do we, once we have that faith or that introduction by faith into grace, okay, and we do that by obedience, okay, then, brethren, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. He says, now, here's the deal. Now that you've done this, here's how you then are going to, how it's going to affect your life. And he talks about it in terms that the Jews of that time would understand really very, very clearly, because under the old law, who offered sacrifices? The priests. And under the new law, who are the priests? Who's Peter say we're the priests? We are a royal priesthood, a holy nation. Okay? So now he says, as he's using that same thought pattern, and he's saying, you guys now need to be sacrifices. You are the priests, but you're not going to go kill an animal. Okay? You're not going to kill anything. What you're going to do is put yourself out there. You are going to say, here I am. I'm the sacrifice. Okay? I am my sacrifice. Now, I'm not making any kind of parallel with us being the same kind of sacrifice Christ was. He is the high priest. Once for all, entered into the Holy of Holies, where he reigns now. But on a day-to-day basis, we do the chores that the priests in that day and time did. And it's a daily job. And so he goes on to talk about then how they do that. Okay, now just going down through the outline, for chapters 1 through 323, all of man disregarded God. The Gentiles are sinners. The Jews are sinners. There's going to be a judgment. There's no partiality with God. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Okay? That's it. That's what's going to happen. Everybody blew it. And then he talks about how to escape the wrath of God. There will be a judgment, and the wrath of God will be rendered. And he says, how do you escape it? Okay? So he says at the end of 3, he says, all are justified by God's grace through redemption in Christ. And then he answers questions in light of this justification. Shall we continue in sin? Shall we sin since we're not under the law but under grace? Is the law sin? Because now they flip it on its head. They say, well, okay, well then if we don't have to obey the law, then is the law sin? And the answer is no, the law wasn't sin. The law was a tutor to bring us to Christ. The law, this is the fulfillment of the law. This is the personification. All of the old law was built, Jesus said, the old law is built on two commandments. What were they? Love God and love your neighbor. And he said, that's what the whole old law was built on. This is the fulfillment of that. It's not where you are just keeping the law by ticking them off, but you are changing your heart, and in that you fulfill the whole law. So the example we used and is commonly used is the rich young ruler who came to Jesus, and he says, what do I need to do? And Jesus says, well, and he starts reciting the Ten Commandments. And the rich young ruler says, what? Yeah, I've done that since, this is looking good for me. But he knows it's not quite enough. And he says, well, what else? I've done these since my youth. And Jesus said, well then, if you have, and you understand this love, you understand the basis of the law, then go sell everything you've got and give it to the poor. And that's where the rubber hits the road for him, because he had a problem with a changed heart. Now, Jesus was not advocating that we all become paupers, because if we did that, we would not be able to meet the obligations we have in life, for instance, to support those who are in need or to support those in our family. But what he was doing was he's saying, look, there's this spot where you fulfill the law. In order to fulfill the law, you have to be doing it by faith. You have to have this changed heart. Okay, so did what is good become death? The answer is no. Then in the eighth chapter, he has this point at which he says, who can bring a charge against God's elect? You know, if God is for us, who can be against us? Who's the accuser? In a court of law, if somebody breaks the law, there's a judge, and then there has to be an accuser, right? Somebody has to say he broke the law. Otherwise, the guy never, ever ends up in the court. Who's our accuser? Satan. Satan's our accuser. So he points out in this section here in chapter 8 that we have total victory and there is nobody that can accuse us because we are justified by God through Christ Jesus. And when we have that relationship, there is no one who can accuse us because we have been justified. What does justified mean? It means set right. And so if it has been set right, then we cannot be accused. And he talks just before that about how under the old law, and that's in chapter 7, he talks about the struggle. Even under the old law, you're always in a struggle because you're not perfect. And then he says, who's going to save us from this? So if you're trying to earn it, you're always in a struggle. I try to do what I was going to do, but I can't do it. And, you know, my mind's here, my body's there. And, you know, he goes back and forth and back and forth. And he says, who is going to save us from this? And he says, praise be to Jesus Christ. And then he rolls into the eighth chapter where he talks about there's no condemnation and us being victors, total victors. Okay, so that's that section. Then 9 through 11, he goes back and he starts talking to them about the inclusion of the Gentiles and the rejection of Israel. But don't get cocky, Gentiles, because the Jews have every bit of access that you have. There will be a remnant that's saved because you're all one now. And so there is one kingdom. And they have access, and they can be a part of this. And he talks about the inclusion of the remnant, okay? But it is according to God's gracious choice, not according to them being able to earn it. They can't earn it, and he points out they don't get it because they're descendants of Abraham. They can't put a pin on their coat that says, I'm a Jew, and have that be anything before God. What they have to do, like all of everybody else, is present their bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God. And when he does that, it breaks down all of the cultural barriers. Okay? So then he talks about, we already jumped ahead on this, the living sacrifice. So what does this mean now in terms of relationships? Well, we in our personal relationships, and then he talks about different ways that we serve one another. Then in relation to civil government, the word operative word there is what? With regard to governments. Yeah, subjection, be in submission. So he's talking in relation to personal relationships, the key operative is service. In relation to our relationship to governments, it is a subjection with the exception of what? Pardon? Right. When we are asked to do something that is in violation of God's law. Okay? Now, this is one of those things where if you want to stretch it out and follow the logic far enough, you can refuse to pay your taxes because they're using your taxes to do things that you don't think are right. Jesus and Paul address that very specifically because it is a logical train of thought. You know, well, if they're going to use my money to promote this, then that's a violation of God's law. Therefore, I should not pay the taxes. And that's, I get that, you know, and I'm glad he put the thing in there because I might be in jail for not paying my taxes. But it's very clear that's not what he's talking about. It's along the lines of if you buy the meat in the market, don't ask. Just go home, fry it up, and eat it, because, you know, it doesn't make any difference if it was killed in front of a rock or not. And just because the rock had a face carved on it, doesn't make any difference. It's still a hunk of meat. Okay? So, okay. Then in chapter 14, he talks about living out unity in the congregation out of respect, in a respectful and unified way, by making room for the weaker brother. And in particular, in the Jewish culture here, he's talking about, he identifies, for example, the eating of meats. And if you've got the Jewish brothers that just can't let go of, you know, they just can't sit down and eat that hunk of pork, it's okay. They're okay. Yes, you do have freedom to eat meat. It's not required of you anymore. And you guys who are the Jews, don't force everybody else to not eat the meat. But, you know, you guys that know it's okay, don't offend your brother by putting them in an awkward situation. So if you got some Jewish brethren coming over to your house, you aren't going to cook a pork roast. It just isn't what you would do. It's unkind. I mean, if we think about this kind of thing, it would be, we can think of all kinds of secular applications where you just wouldn't do that to somebody. You know, you would be polite. And all he's asking them is, look, make the main thing, ignore the stuff that is culturally, makes you culturally different. You know, you need to set those aside, ignore the cultural differences, stay with the truth, and you're good to go. Okay, and then in chapter 16, he has some final commendations and greetings, which we talked a lot about when we talked about the congregation as a whole. And then finally, he has some admonitions about those who cause dissensions and hindrances. And then he talks again about the obedience of faith. Okay, so that was the book of Romans in a nutshell. Okay, so after we did that, then we went on, and we'll pick up here on our review next week. But we went through the book using some keywords. So he starts out and he talks about sin. He talks about grace. He talks about faith and its relation to grace. He talks about justification. He talks about reconciliation, sanctification, and glorification. He uses all of those words, and he reintroduces them in the book in that sequence. Okay? He talks about sin first. He talks about grace. He talks about faith. Well, after his initial summary statement, he talks about sin, grace, faith, justification, reconciliation, sanctification, and finally glorification. Okay? So we'll pick up there. And that's our second time through the book. And then the third time, we went through a little slower and took these chunks and looked at them in a little bit more depth. Okay, that is all for today. Thank you very much. And I have enjoyed teaching the class, and I'll enjoy the next few weeks while we wind it up. So thank you.